Welcome to Last Letters Podcast, a show which asks each guest a simple question. If tomorrow was your final day on Earth, what would your last letter be? It began as a self-reflective question from the show's host, Jeremy Locke. A world traveler and retired Air Force photojournalist, Jeremy is 7-time Military Photographer of the Year and a Bronze Star recipient who has always wondered about his portraits. What would this person's advice to the world be?
Welcome to Last Letters. I'm your host, Jeremy Locke. Today, I have the pleasure of sitting across from a family friend of ours, Lance Bland. Lance is from Crossett, Arkansas, and also a realtor here in Dallas. Welcome, Lance.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Realtor here in Dallas. How's that business going?
Well, it's been pretty good. You know, we had some COVID setbacks, but overall, it's good. I've made a good living at it. I've been at it 18 years, and I've expanded my business into Puerto Vallarta now, because that's where, you know, where I spend a lot of my time. So, yeah, real estate's good. It fits me. I get to do what I want, be my own boss. That's very important to me.
Yeah, it's nice being your own boss.
It is.
Puerto Vallarta. Why Puerto Vallarta?
Puerto Vallarta is somewhere I went for a New Year's Eve trip as a guest of a friend in 2005. And I just love the city. I connected. I've been back there 16 New Year's Eves.
16?
Yeah, it's like at this point, I have as many friends there that are locals as I have friends here.
Tell me about being a little boy growing up in Crossett. Am I saying that right? Crossett, Arkansas.
It's called Crossett, Arkansas.
Where is that?
It's very southeast Arkansas. It's a tiny town. We're known for about three things. The biggest Georgia-Pacific plant in the world was there. Toilet paper, paper towels. We're the home of K.T. Osland, which is one of my favorite country music singers. And Barry Switzer is from there. So everybody knows who Barry Switzer is. It's a small, small town. I would say collectively, it's probably 10,000 people total. And I've never understood this, is my little town, they treat themselves like they're this metroplex. There's North Crossett, South Crossett. I grew up in West Crossett, but there's no East Crossett. Collectively, it's just Crossett, Arkansas. You know, it's its own thing.
Why aren't you living in Crossett now?
because I knew at about 10 years old that I had to get out of Crossett, Arkansas. I had my eyes on the world, and I knew that Crossett was home for me because that's where my parents live. That's where I grew up. That's where I went to school. But I just knew that I didn't click with Crossett, Arkansas. I always knew that I was a very different kid.
In what kind of way?
Well, when you grow up in Crossett, Arkansas, you're going to be a hunter, a fisher, a baseball player, a football player. You're going to be all those things. I was more music oriented, and I was very different from the far as back as I can remember. The honest reason for that is I've known since 5 years old that I was gay. That does not fit the Crossett, Arkansas mode. I knew I was different, and I knew that I had to stay focused and get out of Crossett, Arkansas. And that's what brought me to Dallas ultimately.
Can you tell me about how at 5 years old you knew you were gay?
I just knew. I mean, you hear all these people that say, you know, it's a lifestyle or it's an alternative lifestyle. I have problems with those statements because at such an early age, to be quite honest with you, I knew girls weren't my thing. It just wasn't my thing. And the whole macho thing of being the manly man of Arkansas, it wasn't my thing. I knew. I knew that I was a mama's boy, and that's not a bad thing. It's taken me many years to know that's not a bad thing, to be a mama's boy.
You said that you didn't like girls. Can you tell me how you knew you didn't like girls, or did you look at a man and say, oh, wow, I like him in that kind of way?
Well, I mean, at 5 years old, you're not sexually or mentally developed for that. But I knew that I connected with the girls in my grades and the girls in my schools better than I did with the boys. And there's a Southern mentality of, you know, you have to fit this mold. You have to do these things, play these sports, do these hunting activities, do these. And it wasn't me. Even at an early age, I just knew that my best friends were going to be my girlfriends, who to this day are still my best friends at 45 years old. I think it came from a place of non-judgment. I didn't have to be someone to be around them, be someone I wasn't. Looking back, I think everybody knew I was gay. It's just hard to explain, Jeremy. I mean, it's hard to explain to a straight man how you know at 5 years old that you knew you were gay. I did. I knew it wasn't my jive. And I went through many years of thinking, this is going to change. I'm not going to be this way later. But it's something that's just in you. And that's why I have a problem with when people say you chose this lifestyle. Because no kid in its right mind wakes up and chooses to defy their family, defy how they were raised, defy how they were raised in church, defy what the Bible says. You don't at that early age make those kind of life decisions.
Can you tell me a story where you tried to sit there in your mind or an action that you did that to try to prove to yourself that you weren't gay?
Well, I mean, I've made an honest stab at playing sports. I was actually pretty good at baseball, but it just wasn't my thing. You know, my dad was my baseball coach. I knew I wasn't rough and tough enough to do football. Didn't understand football. To this day, don't understand football. You know, the Super Bowl was last week, and the only thing I was worried about was the halftime show. And, you know, I remember growing up going to all the football games in our hometown. The only thing I cared about was band, what the band was doing at halftime. It's like I just had zero interest in any of that macho man culture. Really, at that early age, it wasn't any kind of sexual thing. Like I hadn't developed sexually. It's just hard to explain. You just know. You just know.
When did your parents just know?
Well, that's an interesting topic. My ultimate plan was is for my parents to never know. I successfully worked through four grandparents dying and never having to tell them or disappoint them. And honestly, my plan was to just be me and do what I do in Dallas and keep it separate from Arkansas and let my parents die never knowing the real me. That honestly was my real plan. But you know, there was an incident in a little family altercation where I was I wasn't a prisoner of war, I would say. I was ammunition in a war. I had a cousin that got into it with my mom, and she used me as a weapon to hurt my mom.
In what kind of way?
Just the phrase of this. Well, Aunt Pam, we all know Lance is gay.
What age were you when that was said?
33. 33 years old. I kept it in to 33 years old.
At 33, Lance, your parents find out.
Right.
But I want to go back a little bit further where you had four grandparents that passed away. And in that statement, you said that you were a disappointment or used the word disappointment. Can you tell me why?
That's the way things are looked upon in South Arkansas. You're viewed as, because they're so religious, sometimes to zealot status, and you're held to these standards, but then you have this burning thing that you know in you that you're not being authentic and you're not being yourself. But you know that if you are to be yourself, you're going to disappoint your family. And it's a very hard thing to live with at 45, a third of your life. It's hard to say and it's hard to know until you've lived it. You wake up every day of your life in a city and a family and a church and a culture knowing that you're different and you don't have a support system. You don't have anyone to turn to. You don't have anyone to talk to. And it's just so hard.
Do you think your family members would have disowned you, stopped loving you?
So at the time, all the way up until the age of 24, I was basically dependent on my parents. because I went to school, I went to college, I got a master's degree. And even though a lot of my college was waived due to talents I had and things I did, you're still kind of under your parents' wing. When I graduated graduate school and I moved to Dallas, I knew that was my opportunity to spread my wings and fly. And that's partly why I chose Dallas. It's because Dallas is 5 hours away from Crossett, Arkansas, and it's far enough away to live your life, do what you want, but it's also close enough to get home if you need to in an emergency. Luckily enough, God brought me to Dallas, and I think he brought me here for a reason. I didn't understand the reasons that I was brought to Dallas or I ended up in Dallas, but I can tell you somebody was looking over me.
What did your parents say to you at 33 when they finally found out that you were gay?
Well, it's interesting because I knew the day was coming because you can only run so long. And I was living in a constant state of anxiety to the point that when my phone rang and it was my mom's name, I thought, today's the day. As any gay kid knows, that's in the closet or can't be themselves, you have that looming thought in the back of your mind, when is this going to happen? How is this going to happen? What's going to be the fallout from this? It started to get too much for me too often that when my phone would ring, if you know my mother, when she wants something, it doesn't matter if it's where she put her cucumber seeds. She's going to call you until she gets you. So my mom calls like it's an emergency. It's like, has my dad been hurt at the meal? And you call home and it's like, I can't remember where I put this. So when your mother starts calling you repeatedly, you start to go into this mode of, is today the day? What am I going to have to deal with? And luckily, I had my younger sister, who's 3 years younger than me, and I went to her and I just told her, and we could talk about anything. That's one thing I could say about my sister. We could talk about anything. I knew that I needed to have my sister in my back pocket for the day that it all went down. And the day that it all went down, my sister called me and she said, "Mother knows."
did she call before?
My sister warned me. Yeah, this is all 2009, and so it's just hard to go back to all that because it was so emotional. My sister was there to help guide my parents through this, that this is not the end of the world. This is the exact same Lance. This is the exact same son that you knew and had yesterday, but today you know another piece of information about him. I am so glad looking back that I hate to say the word recruited, but I did. I recruited my sister as an ally and I needed her. She showed up. My sister was able to broker the situation, mediate the situation, smooth over the situation. And it still took my mom a long time. I think it was 3 months that we didn't talk. Can you imagine 3 months not talking to your mother that you talk to 3 or 4 times a week? It's horrifying. You live in a constant state of anxiety. It's like, are they ever going to accept me? You know the answer is no, or you think the answer is no. The absolute answer is they're never going to understand you. Now, over time, and pretty quickly in the big scheme of things, my parents both, they accept it, but their rules are we don't talk about it.
Did you have a pre-planned message or speech that you were going to give to your mom when she found out?
Oh, I had to think about that. I wanted to tell my parents, being gay is not a death sentence. You know, they think about AIDS. Being gay does not mean I wear assless chaps leading the gay pride parade in Dallas. Being gay does not mean that I'm a drag queen or a cross dresser. You got to think about all those stereotypes that parents think that being gay is. And I remember I even sent my mother an email and it was, this is what your son is, and this is what your son is not. And it was quite lengthy. And I copied my sister on it. And my sister called me, and she goes, well, I can't believe you said that. You know,
give me a couple of examples. What is my son? What is my son not?
What I said was, is you need to focus on the fact that your son is the exact same person that you gave birth to and you raised, and he's the same person that you talked to on the telephone yesterday. Your son, who you helped go to college, turned out to be successful, got a master's degree, moved to Dallas, and has a career. Your son is not, and then I named off all the stereotypes that people in Arkansas think that gay people are. I'm not a drag queen. I'm not a transsexual. You know, I'm not all these things. And you know what? If you are those things, be you, do you. They're not me.
Was there a light bulb moment or?
No. You know, the 3 months that my mom and I didn't talk after the whole thing, the day she called me, it was just a boohoo session. And it was I've been processing this. I didn't know. I didn't have a clue. And I'm sitting here thinking, are you Helen Keller? I mean, it's like, you know, she's deaf and blind. It's like, you didn't know, mother. You had to know.
Have you ever brought a partner home?
Yes.
Do they know?
I mean, I believe in retrospect, they know. They have to know. Your college roommate comes home with you about every other weekend. They have to know. You know, it's like.
Your poor parents.
I know. And you've met them. You've met them.
They're so lovely.
My parents are like salt of the earth people that are just the kindest people. And I will say this. So I'm 45. They've been married 47 years, I believe. Most of my friends' parents have been divorced. My parents are still together, and they are more in love every year. It's just exponential. I've never once in my 45 years of life seen them have an argument. I mean, I grew up in a family that's just amazing. I mean, it's incredible.
There was no talk like, oh, it's about time you came out.
No. You know, there's a long river over there in Egypt called denial. My mother is on denial. That's the joke in the gay community. My mother's instructions were to me is, I know it. Don't bring it home. Don't rub it in our face. And your daddy will never, ever talk about it. And my daddy has never talked about it. And that's okay. I don't need to talk about it with him. I love him. I know 1,000% he loves me. I don't think he has the tools or the desire or anything to talk about it with me. And that's perfectly fine. Nobody wants to talk about it with their dad. Now, my mother, over the course of time, has gone from not even being able to mention the word gay. You know, she would say things like, well, he's one of those type things, or he's, you know. Now, she's kind of, over time, and it took 10 years. I mean, we're not talking, stuff doesn't happen overnight. She acknowledges I'm gay. She has asked me some funny little things. Like, I have to tell you a little story. One time, we were out trimming her shrubs, and she goes, if something ever happened to you in Dallas, would anyone know how to get in touch with us? I said, well, you know, Mother Mandy lives there. You know, Randall. And she just kind of chop, 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 chop. And then she said, well, do you have a significant other in Dallas that knows how to get in touch with us? And at the time, I did have a significant other, but I followed her rules and I didn't want to talk about it. I just didn't want to talk about it. I wanted to keep Crossett, Arkansas, completely separate than Dallas, Texas. There's a Crossett Lance and there's a Dallas Lance.
Is there a shame?
No.
Then why separate the two?
I've never been ashamed of who I am. I have never been shamed by anybody that I know of. Now, I know there's people that have talked about me behind my back in my life. I am not that naive. I have never been ashamed of being who I am. That's a different story from many people in my situation. I just knew that I had to just keep myself focused. I just had to keep my eye on the ball. Now, religious people call that faith. Some people call it hope. I called it, I have to be my own cheerleader. Because I didn't have anybody. I didn't have anybody in my town, Jeremy, to talk to. And even if there were other gay boys, and by the way, there are a lot of gay boys from Crossett, Arkansas, because now they message me and they're married to women. They're singing in the choir in the First Baptist Church. They message me to talk about the situation they're in. But looking back, I'm not ashamed of anything that I ever did or who I am or what I'm doing. I'm being authentic Lance.
But is authentic Lance the real Lance if you're a different person in CrossFit to a different person in Dallas?
I'm not a different person in CrossFit anymore. When I go home, I'm me. I used to go home and I avoided all the topics like, are you ever going to get married? Do you have a girlfriend? Are you going to get a girlfriend? Those are going away. That's the beauty of once you do come out, you don't have to worry about any of that garbage anymore. I had a conversation with my mom probably a year and a half, 2 years ago. And she said to me, she said, I just worry about you being gay because of things that might happen to you or that you might not have the best chance in life.
What does she mean by that?
I think as a parent, and you have to put yourself where they live in the culture they're in, their mindset is if you're gay, you're going to be shunned, you're going to be talked about, you're going to be made fun of, you're not going to have a business opportunity. You know, all those things that a parent does worry about. And I had to sit there and tell my mom, I said, Mother, I live in a place where I'm safe. I'm fine. A lot of my friends are gay. I'm 50-50 on that. You know that. But this was the kicker. I said, Mom, you know what I do for a living and you know the money I make. I would not make that money if I wasn't gay. I can sell homes to gay men who trust me. Straight men who sometimes think I'm a little bit of a novelty. Let's not skirt around the issue. I'm just, you know, everybody wants the cool gay friend, an accessory, if you will. But the biggest portion of my business is straight women. And they love gay men. They trust gay men. I'm not trying to sleep with them. So my mother, the big picture of this whole conversation was, is my mom was so worried that I wouldn't get a fair shake in life. She has no idea or understanding that being gay has not held me back. I'm not going to say I am who I am today because I am gay. I've never let it affect me. To me, I'm a human. I do what I want and I live my life just like everybody else. But for small town mindset, they think I should be one thing or one thing is going to, you know, they just have a thought process of what they know. They don't realize what's out in the world.
Was there a release when it finally went down?
Yeah, it's a double-sided blade. It's out there and there's no turning back, but it's out there and this is going to change things forever. Now, I thought any gay guy you talk to that's in the closet will tell you this. You live in a constant headspace of negativity. It's the what if, what if, what if, what if. Am I going to be set out on a curb? Am I going to be shunned by my family? Am I going to be this? And so there was a total release of the cat's out of the bag. Here we are. What are we going to do moving forward? If my mother has questions, I answer them. And I've learned this from the process. I answer them honestly, because there was a time in my life when I had a horrible breakup, and it's saddening because my mother never even knew I was in a relationship for 8 years because I couldn't talk about it, but she knew. You know, a mother knows. My mother knew something was fundamentally wrong with me. And she just sat me down at breakfast one morning when I was at home in Arkansas. And she said, there is something going on with you, and I want to know what it is. And I'll never forget it. She was putting something in the microwave, oatmeal or something. Or maybe I was. I think I was. And I remember the countdown on that oatmeal. And I thought, today is the day you tell her what the hell is going on in your life. And I told her. It was the first time in my life that I ever had a real one-on-one with my mom. I never, ever had that sit-down heart-to-heart where we both cried. And the things I told her about how my relationship ended and what all went down, she cried.
Take me through that conversation.
Whew. Well, if you ever want to hear a fine Christian Southern Baptist woman drop the F word, this would be the day. I just told her that I'd been in a relationship for 8 years. And I mean, I didn't tell her the down and dirty of everything. And I didn't focus on what the future plans were. I met Michael in Puerto Vallarta in 2007. And he lived in Toronto and I lived in Dallas. I liked him. He liked me. It was New Year's Eve. 6 weeks later, he wanted to come to my birthday. And it was just one of those things. I had finally found someone that I liked and was compatible with. And we made the decision that we were going to be together. And we were for 8 years. And you talk about hard. I mean, when one lives in Canada and one lives in Dallas, so we would meet in other cities. I always knew that he was not coming to Dallas. My income depends on who I know, what I know, the streets I know, the market I know. So there's no just, Lance just moves to Canada. And it's just not that easy to move to Canada. When it came time to do it, I had just bought a condo, gutted it, complete remodel, quit my job. And that's when my friends came to me and they said, you're not going to Canada. And I'm like, oh no, I am. It's time. We've known this for 8 years. And they're like, no, you're not going. And that's when they dropped the bomb on me that he was cheating on me with one of my best friends. That's something you're never prepared for. I mean, it's thinking your buddy circle, one of your top two or three, is cheating with your wife. It's devastating.
That's bro code. We don't go there.
It works in our community the same way, except, you know.
What's your mom say when you told her this?
There was another element to it that my mom knows the person that Michael was cheating with. And, you know, Crossett's a small town and she was not happy. I do remember this. I better not see his mother at Walmart. It's like, I'm going to go all Walmart on you. Going back to that conversation, I have to say this. It's a five-hour drive between Crossett back to Dallas. In the first hour and a half or 2 hours, I cried nonstop. Literally. I cried for the first 2 hours of the five back to Dallas because I just released everything on my mom. I just let her have it. I let her have the real Lance. And ever since then, my mother has been amazing. She's been amazing.
Why do you think that is?
I think we just finally had one of the most real and open and raw conversations we'd ever had. But I think it answered a lot of questions for her of why I am who I am and the way I act and the things I do and the things I say. It gave her a lot of answers.
Being gay 50 years ago in our society is way different than being gay today. It took 33 years. That's 33 years of baggage and heavy lifting that you had to keep secret. There has to be this freedom.
I mean, this is a unique thing about my generation. I was born in 1976. So I've lived through these decades of can't be gay, won't be gay, AIDS crisis. The AIDS crisis of the 80s just put a stigma on being gay. 90s really wasn't any better. But then about 95, 6, 7, I don't know what the year was. There's one thing, and I hate this show. I hate it. But there was a groundbreaking show that came out that made gay okay. It was Will and Grace. Everybody loved Will and Grace, except for me. I didn't like it because I thought it was too stereotypical and I thought it was stupid. It kind of pissed me off. But you have to look at shows like Will and Grace. Modern Family has like made gay like the popular thing. And if you pay attention, if look at every series you watch now has a gay character in it. So media and society has moved in the last 25 years to, hey guys, there's gay people in society. Hey guys, this is a real thing. So growing up now, it's a lot easier to be you and to be who you are. I'm not going to go so far to the point to say that nobody gives a shit, but that's still hard for that kid that's 17 years old living in Alabama, who's living with his parents, who's dependent on their income and doesn't want to disappoint them. I guess my overall message would be is don't waste decades of your life running from who you are, hiding from who you are. It's easier to say that it is done, but rip the Band-Aid off, get it over with. Your parents are going to love you regardless. Most parents are going to love you regardless. Get it done. Life is too short to live in the closet and be unhappy. I just wish I could tell you the burden that was lifted off my shoulders the day that my mother knew. It just takes away all that anxiety.
And then you say God brought you to Dallas?
You know me. You and I have political differences, and you're a lot more religious than I am. And I'm the first one to tell you that I'm not the most religious person on earth. And there's reasons because the church shamed me. The church shamed me. It's the reason to today at 45 years old, I don't even want to put a toenail in a church because it's such hypocrisy. But I do have a deep-seated or deep-rooted spirituality in me that knows that there's something burning in my soul. And you can call it God, you can call it whatever you want. There's something in me that I know led me to be where I am today. I've certainly been blessed by a great city for real estate, but I've been more blessed to be in a city where there's open-minded people, like-minded people, and I have gotten the chance to flourish and live my life. Do what I want, be who I am. Whatever force you want to call it out there in the universe, something pushed me here, and it's been my home for 22 years.
Lance, you grew up going to church in CrossFit. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so we went to the biggest church in town, which was First Baptist Church. You've actually been there. Very strict, devout, follow the Bible, Southern Baptist family. And if the doors were open, we were there. That didn't just include Sunday morning, Sunday school, or Sunday night. We had, I think, Monday night youth group. We had Tuesday night where we'd go out and whoever filled out the cards in church that were the new guests, we would go out and greet them. And there was something every night of church. And in a town like CrossFit, Arkansas, there's not much going on. We had a youth center, but I didn't want to go to the youth center because I didn't fit in. So church was church and church was the activity. You know, there's only a few activities to do in CrossFit, Arkansas. You go to Walmart or you go to church. But church for me was a very uneven balance. It's something you enjoyed. It was a social thing. But then it was also very hard to sit there and hear that you're not worthy. You're a sinner. You're not going to heaven. It's just hard, you know, and it's, you look around at church and you see all these people that are having affairs, having sex, out drinking, all partying all weekend. And you're like, why am I the one man out? You know, the chapter of the Bible, Leviticus, says a lot of things about sinning. I remember one time I had a shirt. I made a shirt that said, what else did Leviticus say? Because everybody wants to be so literal about the Bible. You know, Leviticus basically lays out a lot of rules. Why is homosexuality the one that people just hang on? And so, you know, you sit in church and you're like, why am I the one singled out when you're all doing this or doing these different things? You know, I believe, now don't quote me because I'm not a scholar of the Bible, but I believe somewhere in the Bible that they say sin is sin in the eyes of the Lord. So you're sitting there as a kid thinking, internally, you have the secret that you know, why am I being singled out? And so that's been my problem with church, Christianity, and the whole thing ever since, or my whole life is there's a double standard. And you don't want to actively go participate in a double standard. And you don't want someone from a pulpit sitting there judging you and singling you out. So that's been my experience with church.
You've mentioned I've been to your church. Do you want to go there with that?
Well, I knew we were going to. You know, it's funny. You've always known me as the come over and have drinks and party Lance and fun Lance and swimming pool Lance. And that's our relationship. But you got to visit my church on what to this day has been one of the worst days of my entire life. And that was for my sister's funeral. So, yeah.
Who was your sister?
To me, my sister was... we didn't have that relationship where we talked on the phone every single day. But we did text each other every single day. She wasn't just a sister. She was a best friend. You know, we grew up 10 miles or so outside the little core town. We grew up in the country. You know, there was nobody but my sister and I and our two first cousins that lived next door. She was my best friend. I mean, we grew up together. We played together. We built clubhouses together. You know, there's not much to do when you live out in the country. I mean, it's like, and I say out in the country because it was kind of far. We were isolated. We had a different brother-sister relationship because we were best friends. You know, we were a family of four. It's my sister and I, my mom and dad. And she was just an important person in my life.
How did she die?
This is one of the hardest things. I'm just now getting to this point in my life where I can even talk about this, and it's been 9 months. So on May 15th, 2020, my sister committed suicide. That is a call that you never in your life want to get at 7 o'clock in the morning. Ever. It's the most devastating call you'll ever get.
What do you think the reason was?
My sister had, she had a bout with depression. She had a debilitating disease, rheumatoid arthritis. We have since found out through a lot of things that her marriage was not what it appeared to be on social media. Her finances were not in line. And she lived in pain every single day of her life, physical pain. I'm sure she lived in mental pain. And I think inside her, I think inside her world was crashing and she couldn't deal with it. But we didn't know. We did not know. We didn't know what was going on because she didn't tell us. She didn't talk to us. And then you wake up on a Friday morning and you get a call from a best friend that's on his way to your house to tell you. I mean, the call was, are you at home? And I'm like, yeah, I just woke up and turned my phone on. I'm on the road to your house right now to wake you up. Your mother has called me repeatedly. And I'm sitting here going, why? My friend Randall said, Whitney has shot herself. And the first question I asked was, is she dead? And he said, yes. Jeremy, you can't imagine what goes through your mind. I mean, it's just, you're standing there in your bathroom and someone has told you your sister has just killed herself. It's mind-boggling. It's you talk about a million thoughts that hit your brain at one time. You don't know what to do. You don't know what to do. You don't know what to do. You don't know what to say. I just remember saying to Randall, I've got to go. I've got to call my daddy. I didn't want to call my mother because I knew at that point she was going to be a mess. My daddy is more practical. He's more compartmentalized. He's more, I'm not going to use the word level-headed because they're both level-headed people. My dad's better at a crisis. And I called, and it's actually when the coroner was rolling her out of the house. My dad's on the phone with me as they're rolling my sister out of the house. And I am 5 hours away, and I'm going through my mind of, do I book this little puddle jumper from DFW? No, I don't want to do that. Someone will have to come get me. It's faster for me to just get in my car. You just go in this mode of, this has happened. This is going to change our lives forever. Not my life, our life. I went to eat breakfast because I knew I had to drive 5 hours and I couldn't even eat. I remember making something. I can't tell you what it was. I tried to take one bite and I just thought the best thing I can do is just get in the car. And so I threw all my things. I didn't even get a suitcase down. I just used my laundry basket. I just started throwing things in my laundry basket. My thought process was, I've got to get to Crossit. I've got to get to my mother. I've got to get to my dad. It's just so hard to explain to what goes through your head. Little things, looking back, go through your head like, I had enough sense about me to say, I'm going to need a suit and tie. But then there were things I remember thinking, whatever, leave it. I'll just get it at Walmart and Crossit. And you get in your car and you get on the road and I put my flashers on. And once I got out of downtown Dallas, I honestly can tell you my car never dropped below 90 miles per hour. I don't even remember anything from downtown Dallas until I got to Ruston, Louisiana, which is the exit that you take to go north into Arkansas. And the reason I remember that is because I missed the exit. I was so programmed to, this is happening, I've got to get to my mother, and I started going into mechanical mode is the best way to explain it, because you know I got to get there, I got to see my parents, we got to deal with this, I'm going to be the one that has to deal with the funeral arrangements, I'm the one that's going to have to deal with everything. It's just hard. It's just hard. There's not any words really to put in what goes through your mind when you get a call like that. And I remember pulling up in my parents' driveway and I saw my dad, and he's not an emotional man. He's not a man of not many words, hardly any words. And he just hugged my neck and he said, "You're all we have left." That's the first time I'd ever seen my father be emotional. And I'd been to both of his parents' funerals. My dad's the one that found her. You're a father of two. What would you think if you had found one of your sons dead? And so I met him in the driveway, and we did our whole thing. I just did not want to walk in the house. Because I didn't want to see my mother. I did not want to see her. I knew she was destroyed. She's the emotional one of the family and has always been. But I didn't want to see her. Because no one wants to see their mother like that. Nobody wants to see their mother like this. This was not one of those situations that we had ever been through. This was not me just losing my sister. That was my daddy finding her and my mother losing her child who she carried, who was her best friend. I didn't want to take those 10 steps from the carport inside my mother's front door. I didn't want to see her. That's the hardest 10 steps I ever took in my life. It's like the first words out of her mouth is we failed Whitney. And I'm like, we? What do we do? We don't know what we did. We don't know what we did wrong. We'll never know. That's the thing about suicide is we'll never know what we could have done, what was wrong, what we should have done. That's what you live with after a suicide. You live with a lifetime of what did we not know? What did we miss? That's what you live with. That's what I live with every day of my life now. All the stuff that's happened in my life up until I was 44, that all went away. This has been my focus now. My family. My sister changed our lives. She changed our lives forever.
When did you go from this mechanical kind of state you are in, finding out about her death, to an emotional side when it really hits you?
Well, the honest answer to that is 2 weeks ago. My mother told me a few things that she wanted done for the funeral, and I made those happen. I'm the one that went and planned the funeral. I don't know. I kind of went into this secretarial type thing. Like, I took accounting of everybody that came to the house, everybody that sent food, everybody that sent flowers, everybody sent this, because I knew in a few days, we're going to have to send out the thank you cards. I went through all the steps. I went into this mechanical mode to keep my parents from having to deal with anything. And I ended up staying 10 days after Whitney's funeral. And I didn't want to come back. But I had to come back, Jeremy. I have to work. My job's here. No kid wants to leave their parents like that. And I went in the mode of, all right, Lance, you got to keep going. You have a job. You have a job that needs to be fed like a baby every day. You know, I'm in an industry where you eat what you kill. If you don't work, you don't make money. If you don't lead generate, you don't get sales. If you don't get sales, you don't get paid. I had to like zip up my emotions to deal with moving my job and career forward and still get paid in a pandemic, but also being strong for my parents and letting them know I'm okay and I'm worried about you. Because my parents were my number one worry, especially my mother. I thought Thanksgiving is going to be bad. Christmas is going to be worse. And I was there for both holidays, and Thanksgiving was bad, and Christmas was worse. But I didn't realize until it was Whitney's birthday a month later, it's when it hit me. That's the day I stopped being mechanical. Because at Thanksgiving, I was trying to control and manage the situation just so we could get through a holiday. Christmas, I was trying to control and manage the situation and my mother so we could get through a holiday. And then you fast forward a month later, and it's Lance sitting at his computer in his office by himself, seeing everything my sister's friends had posted about her on Facebook. It just hit me. It was the first time I was alone. It was the first time I stopped trying to control the situation. And I think that's when I stopped being mechanical. I called my mother and I said, today's the day that it finally hit me. I've apologized to my mother because this is one of the major things I've learned out of this whole thing. You cannot judge a grieving mother. You can't judge her for the things she says or does or feels. And I was trying to control that situation. You can't put somebody's grief on your timeline. For some reason in my mind, I thought, if we can just get a few months out, my mother will be better. And then occasionally you'd get a good day. And then you get a bad one. And then you get a good week. And then you get a bad month. And I've just learned you cannot put somebody else on your grieving timeline. I'm busy. I have a lot of things going on. I work, I socialize, I travel. I have a lot of things that keep my mind busy. My mom and dad are retired. They sit at home and they dwell over Whitney, because not only was Whitney their child, Whitney was their best friend, and they miss her. And I get it. I get it. It's hard. I miss her, but I have to move on with my life. I have to continue doing Lance. I have to reach down in my soul and find that thing, just like when I was 5 and 10 and 15 and 20, and just keep going, because I know that things will get better. I don't think my parents have that. I don't think they have that mindset. I think my parents are caught up in this rat race of, it's still so real and raw to them. And it's not forgotten by me by any means. Just really hit me a couple weeks ago. But I have the advantage of having all these things that keep me busy and keep my mind off things. And that's where I am.
What's your emotional state right now with it?
I'm sorry. It's a lot. I've had a whole lot of things, Jeremy. It's, you know, as a sibling, you go through all the sadness and all the things. And then you, to be honest, you go through this. It's the sibling that's left behind and the sibling that no longer matters. And that's a perceived emotion. Of course my parents left me. Of course I matter. But Whitney is the only thing on their mind. And I don't think my parents have taken the time to really think how I feel. I've not felt my emotions matter. My grief matters. I thought maybe there's something called like surviving sibling. Well, I Googled the other night just out of curiosity, because I've been having a hard time with this. There actually is a thing called surviving sibling syndrome, but it's not what I thought it was. Surviving sibling syndrome is actually when you're a sibling that feels guilty because you're still alive. I don't really feel I haven't had the guilt that I'm alive and she's dead. Now, I've gone through the whole gamut of I'm alive and I'm pissed off at what she's left me with, to be honest and raw, because the decision my sister made a permanent fix to a temporary situation that we have to live with the rest of our lives. We're the ones that have to pick up the pieces the rest of our lives. We're the ones that suffer the rest of our lives. You're gone. We're living. We're the ones here. And I've had to work through that. And I don't know that I'm going to get past it, to be honest. I don't. It's hard. Every holiday from here on out until the day I die is going to be, I'll just say it, ruined. I lost my mother the day I lost my sister.
What do you want from your parents right now? Honestly.
The only thing I want from them is really what I already have. They support me. They love me. They're going through the season of a very traumatic event. I don't really need their attention. I don't really need anything from them other than sometimes I feel that this whole thing is one-sided, and a little recognition every now and then that, hey, Lance, you're going through this too, would go a long way. And I get it. It's not a judgment. Jeremy, it's not a judgment. You cannot judge a grieving parent. No one gets a hand guide with suicide. No one gets a hand guide with any kind of death. We're all going through this together. There's just no way to explain it, then it's just very difficult and it's very hard. And I just have to stay focused on me and my business and what I'm doing in my life. I'm still living.
Is that an easy answer for you? I got to stay busy. I got to stay, you know, focused on my life.
Well, it's not an easy answer. I mean, it's the answer because, I mean, no one else is paying my bills. I have to work. I have to do my thing. You know, and What people don't understand is, you know, all my girlfriends are like, oh, I have this kid and this kid, and he has to be here and he has to be here. And all they do is whine about their kids. Well, you know what? I have a kid in the same sense. I have to get up every single morning and feed my business. I have to take care of my business. I have to take care of my clients. I have to take care of everything. It's not a 2 or 3 or 4 year old running around pulling on my coattail, but that's my business. And I have to focus and put my energy into that. It's not an escape from Whitney. It's not an escape for what's going on in my world, but it does keep me out of the recliner like my mother watching TV, dwelling on what's going on. You know, I have things that must be done, have to be done, that keep me preoccupied. And that's why I wish I could get my mom a little more social and out and in support groups. And, you know, it's just hard when your parents aren't really social people. I'm not using all the things that I have going on in my life as an excuse not to deal with my sister. I have things that just have to be done. I will tell you to this day, when I lay my head down on my pillow at night, as I'm falling asleep, I think about my sister. I think about things like, why the hell did she leave us behind doing this? Did she even think about what she was going to do to us? Did she even care? I think about what went through her mind the second before a bullet went through her head. That's a hard question you ask yourself every night.
Do you think you'll get to a point where you'll be at peace with it?
Well, the optimist in me thinks so. I think I'll get to a point. No, I know I'm going to get to a point. But the one thing that holds me back is not the right term. Let's just say it this way. Until my mother moves on and my mother is healed, I'm never going to be complete.
Why?
Because my mother means everything to me. My daddy can handle it. He's a strong man. But my mother, she's going to deal with this to the day she dies. And I don't think she's ever going to accept it, deal with it, move past it. And I'm sorry. When you grow up a mama's boy, you're worried about your mama when you're grown. And I'm worried about my mother. I'm worried about her. She'll never be the same.
Have you had this talk with her? Like,
yes.
You won't move on until she moves on? That's heavy.
We at Thanksgiving had a talk that I wanted to have with her when I was leaving CrossFit, because I needed to say some things to her that I knew she didn't want to hear. Within 2 hours of my arrival, she opened up the conversation and I walked right on in, and it wasn't a good trip. Because I said things to her that...
Take me through the conversation.
Well, I just told my mother. I was like, Mother, I understand what you're going through, and I can't put you on a grieving timeline, but I need you to understand that you can't call me every morning at 9 o'clock with something dealing with my sister when I've got to go be with clients and show property at 11 o'clock, and this is on my mind all day. This is affecting me mentally, physically, and financially. And that sounds like an asshole. It sounds like an asshole, but it's the truth. You have to start dealing with your own things on your... You can't drag somebody into something every single day. Now, she's my mother. I'm her son. But every day it can't be the Whitney show for the rest of my life. Counselors and psychologists will call it the anger phase. I have anger. Because I have to deal with something every day of my life with my sister's suicide. And that's something I didn't ask for. That's something that got dumped on me. It got dumped on us. I tried to explain that to my mother in the most sensitive way I could. I don't think the message was received that way. And sometimes, to be honest, that's the way I communicate. I'm a black or white person. There's very little gray in my life. It's black or white. You get on board, get off board. We're doing this, we're not. And when you're dealing with a grieving mother, it's a very delicate situation. But I needed my mother to understand, Mother, I cannot deal with Whitney every single day because you got an email from somebody, or you got a letter in the mail from somebody, or somebody said this. It cannot become my problem every day, because it puts me in the mindset of, now I'm reliving everything also, but I have to work. You see what I'm saying?
Can you speak to the difference? Would it be different if Whitney suddenly died compared to a suicide?
Oh my God. So I've actually thought about this question. You know, that's one of those topics I have a strong opinion on it. If someone dies of an illness or terminal illness, you know what's coming. You know, at our age, that our parents' deaths are coming. You know that if you sign up for the military, there's a possibility you may be coming home in a casket draped in a flag. If you have a car accident, it's horrible. It's sudden. If you have a suicide, my opinion, I'm speaking from my point of view, the only thing I can think of in life that would be worse is if she was actually murdered. Because you would have that anger. You would have that, I need justice. I need this.
At someone else.
At someone else. Whereas a suicide is, you turn everything onto yourself. What could I have done? Why didn't she call me? Why couldn't she talk to me? What was really going on in her head? Those are things we'll never know, Jeremy. It's not to discount a loss in someone's life in any form, because all loss is horrible, whether it's natural causes or whatever. I'm telling you about the losses I've had. This is not a grandparent. This is not a best friend. This is a suicide of your sibling. And we don't have the answers. And we live with that. We live with it every day. And we will. One thing I would like to drive home is suicide is not the answer. Do you know how many thousands of gay kids commit suicide every single year? Because they're not equipped for what they're dealing with. They live in fear of rejection, being shunned, can't accept who they are.
Well, how do you equip somebody like that?
Well, you don't. You just have to reach down in yourself and equip yourself with it. Unless you live in a city where you have a support group. I didn't have one. But the topics that we've talked the most about today, they both usually end up in the same result. And it's horrible. No gay kid in this country or the world should ever think suicide as an option or an answer.
Nobody in general should.
No. It doesn't matter about your financial situation, your marriage situation, your sexuality. It doesn't matter. Those are all temporary things that can be worked out over time. And when you commit suicide, it's a permanent fix to a temporary situation. But it's also, I don't know what the word is, it's a punishment or a curse or a burden, or it affects everybody in your life for the rest of their lives. And that's what people need to understand. You're only thinking about you, your troubles in that moment. You need to think about everybody in your life. We're the ones that are living that have to deal with it the rest of our lives.
There seems to be this commonality with this bottling up. You know, here you are, a gay kid, bottled it up for 33 years. And then whether you're gay, straight, your sister bottled something up, which led to a suicide. Is there something to that?
You have to have faith, and you have to have the strength in your soul, and you have to have the mindset of things will just get better. They will get better. Look, I've lived through some pretty shitty times in my life. You just have to know, outside looking in, that things will get better. They will get better. It doesn't have to be a simple fix of suicide. Things get better. Change your support group. Change your friend group. Change the people that are there for you. If it's not working for you, you can change things. You know, that's what I did. That's what's got me through life.
Question for you, Lance. It took you 33 years for somebody else to bring out that you were gay.
Right.
What would you like to say to that younger gay kid
do not wait. We're only granted so many days and years on this earth. Why not live them happy? Why not live them free? I don't care if you're 19. I don't care if you're 25. I don't care if you're 30. Look, I know people in the closet. They're in their 60s. It's time to come out. It's time to be you. It's safe. I don't know. I don't have the words of wisdom, Jeremy. And like I said, it's a lot easier sitting in this chair saying this on this microphone than it is the practical life application. Because culture and religion and parents and money and all kinds of things control you. But if I could sit here at 45 and tell myself at 5 or 10 or 15 what I know now, I would just say, rip the Band-Aid off. It's going to be bad. Let's not kid anybody. It's not going to be going to Six Flags and riding a roller coaster. You're going to get through it, and it's going to be better. Be free. Be who you are. And if your parents do reject you, there is always somebody in this world that will love you. And if you need to talk to somebody, message me.
Lance, what ran through your head when I asked you to write your last letter?
Well, the first thing that ran through my mind is, what kind of story do I have? What can I contribute to this? When you told me the whole platform of last letters, I was like, why would anybody care about me? Looking back, there's a lot of people out there like me. People message me, and there's people that are hurting, and there's people that just need support. And so I have a story that it's a different perspective than what's been on last letters. And so that's why I wanted to share my story.
Would you read us your last letter?
Oh, goodness. There's a lot to unpack here. All right. You know things in life. I knew when I was very young that I was different. I knew then I had to change my environment. I knew I had a wonderful family, but that my hometown held me back and held me down because I was different. Coming from a devout Baptist family that didn't miss a day that the church doors were open, growing up believing that God didn't love you, believing you were an abomination because I was gay. And I knew that when I was 5 years old. I knew that God loved me and created me because the Bible said God made us all in His image. But why would God make me gay? Growing up in a small rural town with a very conservative, closed-mind mentality, I lived in fear. Fear of being harmed, fear of being outed, fear of not fitting in, but most of all, the fear of disappointing my parents. I was teased and made fun of daily. I was called light in the britches. I was called sissy. I was called faggot. I knew at that early age, I need to be my own cheerleader. I need to be my own motivator. I need to be my own light. I knew that a college education was my ticket out of that town. I wasn't the top of my class, and I sure wasn't athletic. So I focused on playing the trumpet, and I literally tooted my own horn and got a full paid scholarship to college. And I got my ticket out of CrossFit, Arkansas. I knew an education could take me anywhere, and ultimately it brought me to Dallas, Texas. Lucky enough to land my dream job after getting my master's degree, I knew quickly my dream job wasn't really what I wanted to do. I hated my job. I had zero passion in it. It was only a paycheck. After 4 years, I knew that I had to make a change. I knew that I had to take control of my life, my career, and I had to be steadfast and laser focused to build my own business and be my own boss. I rolled the dice and found my calling. I was to be a real estate agent. Real estate has afforded me a nice life and to do what I love the most, travel. I love to travel. My life was amazing. Everything was perfect. I was loving my job, loving travel, loving my relationship. But then my 8-year relationship ended. My heart broke. No, it literally broke. At 40 years old, I'm in the hospital. Diagnosis, broken heart syndrome. That's a rare heart attack, especially for a man. My heart, with so much love for this world, broke. Nothing makes you reevaluate your life, what you're doing, what's important and what's not important, like laying in a heart hospital for 3 days. I knew then, tomorrow is not guaranteed. On May 15th, 2020, I got a call at 7 a.m. that no one ever wants to get. My only sister committed suicide. The most horrific experience of my life. Our family lives in a constant state of shock, often asking, what could we have done? I don't know if my sister ever gave thought to the aftermath she was leaving behind. I don't know if she thought of the pain, the misery, and the lifetime of heartache she left us with. But I do know we will spend the remainder of our lives trying to piece it together. I now constantly worry for my parents. I do know, as a surviving sibling, I matter, but sometimes it feels like I do not. I know, in the big picture, my parents are what matters the most. Yes, I lost a sister, but they lost a child. I don't know how to process Whitney's death. There is no hand guide for grief. But I do know I still have to get up in the morning and try to take care of myself. I do know I have to get up in the morning and feed my business like a child. I know I still have to get up in the morning and stay positive and focused. I know I have to get up in the morning and have faith that things will get better. I know I have to live my life to the fullest. I know that I am my own cheerleader. In life, you just know things.
When you say you know, is that your internal voice?
Definitely. I mean, I'm sure we've all had this same life experience. Yes, it's the internal voice that you have, the internal drive that you have, the internal faith that you have. I wish in my life I had listened to my inner voice earlier and not sacrificed 15 years of my life, happiness, being me, living out loud, if you want to say that. I wish also that my sister could have expressed her inner voice and talked to us and told us what was really going on in her life. And we wouldn't be in this situation today. I mean, we might be, you never know. You know, that inner voice, it's a powerful thing. We know when something's right. We know when we feel something in our gut. We know when something's not on kilter or not going to work. I think we all need to listen to that.
Lance, I know you are meant to be here, and I can't thank you enough for sharing these important experiences we can all grow from. Thank you.
I love you. You know that.
Love you too, bro.
Lord.
Thank you to our guest, Lance Bland, for sharing your inspiring life's journey. We hope you and your family find peace. In loving memory of Whitney Bland, there is always help out there. If you or someone you know needs support in the LGBTQ community, please reach out to The Trevor Project, toll free at 866-488-7386 and thetrevorproject.org. If you or someone you know need support with suicidal thoughts or feelings, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline 24/7 at 800-273-8255. Tune in every Tuesday for a new last letter. Thank you for listening.